This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
This is Things I Found Online. And if you look very carefully online, swabbing every surface, testing every nook, studies show that you will find science.
Science!
Joining us today to examine the intersection of social order and science is a scientist, Dr. Michael Gulen. I am Jamie Alcroft here with Danny Mann,
hey.
Dina Friedman, and our host, Louise Palenka. Wheezy?
Thank you,
nine
Jamie.
E's and Wheezy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jamie. Welcome, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us. We open the show with this entirely unscientific question. Jamie and Danny, what have you found online?
Well.
Wow.
Speaking for both of us.
Go ahead.
The lady eating ice cream off of her head.
Oh, I missed that one.
I found the lady eating ice cream off of her head online.
Off of her own head?
And I thought it was fun. It was a fun Camera video. Turn. We can't show the video, but we can... There.
Oh, I see.
There. There's a still from it. It's just...
She also won the sculpture contest in the Quebec Festival last year.
Mm-hmm. She was a favorite flavor.
Yes. So this is, it's a picture here of Mick Jagger with a face mask on to prevent, exposure to the virus. And then the Rolling Stones logo tongue sticking out of it. And I had the caption of, I can't get no satisfaction.
Aha, sanitation.
And but the bigger topic, I guess, is anytime something like this thing happens out there, of course there's going to be humor and laughter about it, which helps take the edge off the panic.
Until you die.
But there have been some very funny pictures and things come out of it. One was I went to the gym this morning and I had been warned, if you go to place, blah, 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 wipe everything down.
There they are.
And I went and worked out this morning. I wasn't quite that far, but I did wipe everything down carefully and I was a little reticent. But other people are just carrying on as normal.
Yeah.
There's always that scale of like 0 to 10. Some people are in full panic toilet paper hoarding mode, mm-hmm. and other people are kind of going, you know what, if it gets bad,
hey,
I'll do something.
Yeah, so, somebody'll do something for me.
Now the Shatner thing, if you still have that thing up, that was a great divorce settlement thing, that one of the oddest things ever won in a divorce settlement.
Yeah, I don't know.
It says William Shatner awarded horse semen in his divorce settlement.
Yep.
Well, that's a winning day.
Yeah. You can't top that, kids.
Mm-mm. Well, I want to introduce our guest. He is Dr. Michael Gulen, science reporter, author, instructor, editor, and 3-time Emmy Award winner. Was born in East Los Angeles, earned his BS from UCLA and the equivalent of 3 PhDs from Cornell University in physics, mathematics, and astronomy.
There you go.
Can you spell multitasking?
Did he ever go to a college party?
There you go. Well, we'll find out today.
For 8 years, he was an award-winning physics instructor at Harvard University. For 14 years, he was the Emmy Award-winning science correspondent for ABC News, appearing regularly on Good Morning America, 2020, Nightline, and The World News Tonight.
Wow.
Dr. Gulen is a best-selling author and a regular columnist for Fox News. He hosted the History Channel series Where Did It Come From? And produced the award-winning family film Little Red Wagon.
Great movie.
Dr. Gulen is the chairman and president of Spectacular Science Productions and Spectacular Science Foundation and lives in the Dallas area with his wife, Laurel, number of barnyard animals. Can you name it like three animals? Three animals.
So we have a horse named Jim Dandy. A sheep named Lady Guinevere, and two donkeys, let's see, Seymour and Violet. Violet is a mother.
Oh, wow.
Were these all named after relatives?
My wife saying that's her thing, and she enjoys it.
That's
great. You're on a first name basis.
Looking out the window and watching them, that's it.
Sure. Laura Michael has launched this YouTube channel. His latest book is called The End of Life as We Know It. Ominous news from the frontiers of science.
The feel-good read of the day.
Yeah.
And Michael, you delve into how the World Wide Web came to be. And since this is a show about the internet, I thought because you kind of explore where is it headed and the effects it's having on the human species and our way of life. So my question for you is, was the internet inevitable?
I think it was. It's a great question, Louise. I think it was because the opening chapter to my book, I have three big sections. The first section, I deal with the World Wide Web, and then I deal with AI, and then I deal with genetic engineering, and then I deal with surveillance technology. But that first section on the web, that first chapter, I talk about the history that led up to the internet. And if you kind of reflect on how it came about, through the invention of the telegraph, through the invention of the telephone, then television, then computers, and then we had the internet, and then after the internet in 1989, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, it was just a kind of a nobody British scientist who came up with the idea that, hey, maybe there could be electronic libraries and that we could connect them through this telephonic system, this internet that was very new at the time. And his boss actually scoffed at the idea, but he kept at it. And in 1991, he launched it. So I think, I think, Louise, it was inevitable. It's actually even a deeper question that, because now you have me thinking about things like the A-bomb and the H-bomb, and you wonder, were those things inevitable? Was there anything we could have done to stop it? Let's say World War II never happened. Would nuclear weapons still have been discovered? And I think so. I think there's something inexorable about science that once you become curious about something, it leads you to a certain outcome.
Can I just cross-examine? No, just a thought on one of your thoughts there that the war kind of pushed the science that was developing towards something that could be used in war. Had there not been war, or had science been going along developing certain things, don't you think that rather than a bomb being created, some amazing other usage of that technology would have evolved rather than something to kill people with?
Well, that was the original intention.
What was?
Of nuclear science.
Was what?
Anything other than harming people that Einstein was deeply troubled by. I'll let the scientists answer.
Power.
Well, it's a good question. Again, I wish I could say we could have avoided the bomb. I don't think so. When you look at the history of that period of time, even before World War II, we already were discovering Leo Szilard and a lot of others, Enrico Fermi. Other scientists were already discovering the process of nuclear fission. Mm-hmm. And we knew just from basic physics, especially from special relativity E=mc², that when you fuse certain elements together, inevitably it gives off energy. Now, naturally, we use that to create nuclear reactors, and some people have very mixed feelings about them, but that's a peaceful use of nuclear fission. Mm-hmm. But I think, Michael, it would have, it's inevitable. You're right, Louise. You know, Einstein was an interesting guy. I've spent my life studying about him, and I've read his publications and biographies. I myself wrote a biography of Einstein in my book, Five Equations That Changed the World, one of those five being E=mc². Mm-hmm. He was the one who wrote the letter to Roosevelt encouraging him to create the atom bomb because we had information that the Nazis were creating one.
Oh.
So there was a lot on the line. But afterwards, he and all his not all, but many in his generation, many of them who I came to know when I was a young man, really regretted it. It's almost like the regret, actually I'm thinking of it now, it's almost like the regret we're seeing among Silicon Valley executives, people who co-founded Facebook and other social media, the Twitter and so forth, who now regret what they did because they see how social media has so...
Now that I know what people are doing with it, I wish we hadn't done it quite that way, maybe.
But couldn't you establish that every invention has equal amounts of good versus...
I think so, Louise. I would go along with that. I think, we're talking about the internet, and I've reflected a lot on the internet. I wrote about it in the book. I think the internet is just a reflection of us in our full glory, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Because if you take basic elements like water and fire, they can be a good thing or a bad thing. It's all how we use everything on the planet. It's all our intention.
Because even, there's so much technology. For example, I know we're not going to probably talk about it in the show, but one of the sections I deal with in the book is surveillance technology. And, we're developing techniques, for example, to read minds. The idea being that it can help down the line one of the things we envision is that can help people who are quadriplegics who can't move their limbs through their minds. They can affect, say, a robotic arm, brings them a drink of water. It gives them an unprecedented degree of freedom. But at the same time, you can easily imagine that kind of mind reading technology, that kind of interface between the computer and the brain, like Elon Musk's, you know, neural net. You can see how that can be abused, and it will be abused.
Some men may enjoy it because it will be an opportunity for them to actually understand women.
Well, I won't go so far as to say it.
Just because you can read our mind doesn't mean you would understand it.
That's right. Oh, good one.
Michael, we all get that the internet has changed the way we problem solve and approach any task. How is this impacting the wiring of our brains?
Well, it is interesting because if you look at young people who grow up with the internet.
Yes, this is what I'm curious about.
We know that it's affecting the way their brains are wired because it's affecting the way they take in or imbibe information. You know, it's one thing to sit there as a kid and play with blocks and with other things that involve you know, eye-hand coordination. You learn in a different way than when you just sit there and kind of passively take in information from the internet. And you can almost imagine the quantum differences there's going to be in the way we learn when we actually do connect our brains with the internet. I mean, this is not science fiction. This is for real now.
And I would argue that it's extremely interactive for a child to be playing a game where there's a consequence to every action rather than looking at a TV screen. And if you take take your day, for example, Michael, you got up and you looked online and you checked your calendar, or if you had to go somewhere, you maybe used a navigation system, or you know, you communicated with your wife to find out if she needed more of this or less of that.
It's
informing every thought, I think, and every concept, because we don't just sit at a bar and argue who had the most home runs in 69.
We look it up,
yeah.
You don't have to memorize it.
We know that the answer is out there, and then knowledge builds upon knowledge. So are we breeding super brains of people that can go as deep as they want in any subject that interests them?
Well, I think so. That's where we're heading. And, you know, I have a whole section in the book about cyborgs and how we will not only enable learning, like, you know, you can download an entire language, let's say. Once we get that interface between the brain and the computer locked down, you literally inject a mesh. Just in case your viewers are wondering, we've done this with mice. You put a little net inside of a syringe, you inject it into the brain cavity of a mouse, and it's basically like flinging a fisherman's net. The net opens up inside the brain cavity, and it surrounds the brain and eventually gets embedded. The brain cells grow around the net. And so now you have an opportunity to connect with that either wirelessly or through wires with the internet. So you can surf the internet. You can download an entire language.
Wasn't this all covered in Pinky and the Brain?
Just to make a point that I agree with you, Louise. I remember growing up, TV was the big thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a very passive medium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd sit there and watch for hours and hours and hours. Now with the internet, it's much more interactive up to a point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the same as exercising. It's not the same going out and playing and learning out there. But it is different. Look, this is all just inevitable. It goes back to your original question about the inevitability of the internet. I think it's just inevitable. There is, it's almost like a locomotive. Science is like a locomotive, maybe you can compare it to. Mm-hmm. That it's just going to speed along, and I don't see any way of stopping it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
for better or for worse. And I think when you look ahead to the kind of the possibilities of becoming cyborgs, where we actually implant things to enhance our eyesight, our ears, other parts of our body.
Fingers, myself, maybe a heart and a liver, maybe.
Yeah. You know, Jamie had a heart transplant, but you know, that's old tech.
That's old tech.
Remember Jarvik? That was decades ago. Even that's old tech. We're going to go past that.
Well, it's all an evolution. It's really science to me is an evolution. Alfred North Whitehead said,
human life is driven forward by dim apprehensions of notions too general for its existing language. So when we grasp something, and there's a change in our society, we take years and years to evolve to it. Mm-hmm. But I love the evolution that the internet is taking us through. It's a social evolution. It's a technological evolution. But it's a change for human beings, a radical change.
Well, we stand on the shoulders of giants. So from there, you can see like a wider vista. And then you have this layer of knowledge, and you can build upon that so that the growth is exponential. But it can become dizzying, right, Michael? Mm-hmm. Especially if you're a scientist and you know way more than we do about what could go wrong. So since your book is so ominously titled, should we be scared?
The publisher and I actually went round and round and round on that one word in the subtitle. What did we, was it the exciting news from the frontiers? Was it the depressing news? We kind of settled on ominous.
We were going to call it Fluffy Daisies, but
fear sells. Note the lack of toilet paper.
But yes, the internet. I agree with you, Jamie. There's a lot to love there. Right now we're. You have elderly people who are concerned about going outside their homes. They can communicate with their doctors through telemedicine. Mm-hmm. You have kids in Africa who can receive an education through to remote distance learning, mm-hmm. and so forth. And the fact that you can just Google anything, it's ridiculous. It's literally having the U.S. Library of Congress and the Harvard Library of Alexandria at your fingertips and then some.
Michael, quick question. Do you, in the scope of science from before the time we're alive here, would you say that the era that we're alive in right now, that in our lifetimes we have seen more exponential growth and more and more amazing innovation than any other people that were alive for 80 years at any other time in history?
Any other generation.
I think it's relative, Michael. I think that Laurel, my wife's grandfather, who just passed away at the age of 99. It's amazing. He was a Buffalo soldier one of the last surviving Buffalo soldiers.
Jeez. Oh, my gosh. Jesus from Buffalo.
He spoke to us about, how jarring the invention of the automobile and then the telephone and so I think it's relative, but I do think that if you look at it objectively, yes, I think that just by its very nature, knowledge is viral. It builds on itself exponentially. It builds on itself multiplicatively, not additionally. And it's interesting that around 1993 or thereabouts, maybe don't quote me on that, but it was right around there. It was shortly after the internet was launched, that more information was encoded digitally than was on paper, and that is considered to be the beginning of the digital age. And so, I think once you digitize things, it just takes off. That's why I felt I needed to write this book, and it's not a depressing book. It's actually a kind of a survival guide for the 21st century. It's just meant to open your eyes to what's going on right now in labs around the world so that you can be prepared to make wise decisions. Some of it is very frightening. Some of it's very exciting. It's like Louise said earlier. It's kind of half and half. Mm-hmm. It's even with the internet. Yeah, there's a lot to love, but there's also a lot to be just frightened by. I know Zuckerberg, when he launched, for example, Facebook Live, his idea was, well, now we can kind of all share experiences and now by knowing one another better, we can get along better. And it's all very kind of well-intentioned. But, now we have people kind of filming their own suicides. We have people, filming others torturing each other.
It can go as dark as it can go like
torturing others and so forth. It's just horrible. But there again, I said, the internet is us.
Right. That's every invention ever. It's like when something amazing is invented, or there's some wonderful thing out there, there's always part of society that's going to go, how can I abuse this? How can I crack it? How can I make money off of it? How can I steal
it? It mirrors the human condition, so it can be as dark as it can be light.
Right.
But Jamie, you had a question?
I think he just had to go to the bathroom.
No, I because I wanted I jumping off of what Danny had asked, and you talking about your father-in-law, the Buffalo Soldier.
Oh, my wife's grandfather.
Your wife's grandfather. So, yeah. Is it possible that even though things are moving forward extremely rapidly, we've become kind of numb to it, as opposed to plugging in a radio and hearing a voice come out of a box? That must have seemed completely otherworldly and more shocking and more fantastical than any of the innovations that we kind of have become accustomed to. The first time you heard somebody's voice on the telephone, once we were wired for electricity, or one, there must have been those moments where people got in the car for the first time where they just went, oh my God.
Yeah.
What is happening to me?
The first time they showed a photograph to a guy in the jungle, here, I took your picture. It's like, they thought they were stealing their souls.
What about when they showed the first movie, the Lumiere brothers, right? Mm-hmm. It was like a train and everyone in the theater started running away.
You're right.
So, yeah, I mean, it just to have had someone in your life that could describe those moments to you, I hope we keep reading biographies of people that were there at the beginning of the industrial age to talk about what that felt like, because I do think that we've just become kind of accustomed to, virtual reality. Yeah. Okay, so it's going to look like my doctor's in the room with me. Like, we're not going to be that surprised.
Yeah, I mean, even like what we're doing right now, you guys are in Southern California, I'm in Dallas, Texas, and we're just sitting here chatting like we're in my living room. I mean,
Danny's running out of the room because he thinks it's coming
right
at him.
It's amazing.
Breathe.
And by the way, even though I've been a scientist for many years, I still do retain that kind of childlike fascination.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's part of what you will sense in reading the book. But I have not lost my sense of wonder.
Oh, good.
Even after all these years, I can look through a telescope, whether it's my own telescope in my own backyard, or I go to the top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii.
In scanning your accomplishments and your bio, but the thing that pops into my head with PhDs and books, and what do you do to be goofy? What have you done that is like silly fun that people would go, really? He does that?
You know, it's funny you ask that, because I was telling my wife the other day, I need a hobby. I work too much. I just a few days ago, I just started playing the stock market. I said, man, I need just something to, I need something to do that's fun. But I guess I'll be honest with you, I've always had a good sense of humor.
Oh, that's good.
I don't take myself too seriously.
You've always been full of hope, Michael.
Yes.
For as long as I've known you. It's always the one word that I think of when I think of you is hope. You instill hope in other people. You obviously possess it within yourself, and you go through life just making everybody's life a little bit better. And
sharing
I think
hope.
That's really
sharing
great.
Hope. Can you talk about how scientists are pushing the boundaries of morality?
Yeah. Ooh.
Oh, wow.
Well,
just casual.
Well, you love me the easy ones, don't you?
Yeah.
One of the things that I would point to is there are two groups of scientists in Minnesota, one in Minnesota, one in California, Northern California, who are experimenting with what we call chimeras, C-H-I-M-E-R-A-S. Mm-hmm. These are animals whose DNA is a hybrid of two or more species. So in this case, these hybrids are a combination of human and sheep and human and pig. That you can literally,
I
we
think
have
I've met a couple
the ability
of those.
To, yeah, we now have the ability to piece together DNA the way kids piece together Legos.
And can you make a liger?
So we're creating entirely novel species of animals. And I quote one of the scientists in my book. He says, look, if you get the proportions just wrong, you could end up it's funny, but it's not funny, that you could end up with a sheep that thinks that has human thoughts. I mean, it's literally a human trapped inside of a sheep's body. That's pretty. Oh,
that's a Disney movie. My dad, the sheep.
Remember, I want a percentage, Louise. Remember, you heard it.
I don't know. Isn't that basically, that's where a Labradoodle came from, right?
Possibly.
Well, I don't know.
You know,
about
some people will say that, hey, what's the big deal with genetic engineering? We've been breeding animals and crossbreeding animals, but it's a big difference. Here's the difference. It's like the difference between going to Las Vegas and playing the odds and becoming very expert at playing the odds versus literally rigging the wheel, rigging the wheel of fortune, or rigging the whatever you call it, the thing.
I'm roulette. Not a big, the roulette.
The roulette. Thank you. You can see how much. Yeah. How much of a gambler I am.
Yeah. So well, you there's now, a good hobby for you.
You're the playing speedy deal.
Yeah, there you go. Deal. I don't think my wife would approve, but maybe.
Yeah, the difference between learning the game and practicing and cheating.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And then, so now we've gone from being able to read DNA. Remember, that was the big deal. Those were the headlines when Clinton was in office.
Mm-hmm.
He had Francis Collins at the Oval Office making an announcement that we had basically deciphered and read the human genome. Now we have matriculated from that. Now we're actually not just reading it, but we're writing DNA. We're writing entirely novel species that have never existed on the face of the earth. Yeah. I don't know if you guys are science fiction fans, but I remember as a kid watching a movie called The Island of Dr. Moreau. That's where we're at now.
Well, we're taking the kids to DNA World next weekend.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see what they come up with this year.
Michael, as you mentioned in your book, you also delve into AI, robot surveillance technology, and genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. How are our lives about to change in ways that we cannot imagine?
Well, I quote a poor woman. I think she was from one of the southern states, and she was just trying to make a living, and she tells the story of how she was Bigfooted not once, not twice, but three times by a robot. She lost her job. Her first job was in a printing office where she was feeding paper into a printer. Well, they made a robot to do that, and then on and on and on. So it's very real for many people. And by the way, not just blue collar people, people out there who are blue or white collar or pink collar, they shouldn't shrug this off. Right now, all the estimates are that about 50% of human labor, whether it's white collar, pink collar, blue collar, or no collar, can be replaced by a robot. So this is a very real thing. Of course, this has spawned ideas like, universal basic income, because we're foreseeing that robots are going to pick people out of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you do to support them? Mm-hmm. So this is a very big area. I talk about it in great detail in the book. Again, I have each section starts with a chapter that kind of walks you through the history of how we got to this point. Mm-hmm. I call it Memory Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And so I recount the history of robots. It's actually, we've been making robots for a very long, centuries, but most of them were very small and they were mechanical. But again, there's this kind of inexorability, this kind of inevitability. Mm-hmm. That as we pursued our curiosity, it's almost like following our noses. I just don't see how we can stop it. And so now we're at a point where we can, we have robots or AI programs that can beat us at chess, certainly checkers, that was easy. Chess, now Texas Hold'em poker, Jeopardy, the all-time Jeopardy champion was put up against IBM's Deep Blue, Watson, and Watson just kick the pants off of the Jeopardy champion. I quote the world chess champion like Kasparov and others, and they're just like they're like depressed that they once thought themselves as these kind of heroic figures, and now they're just being demolished by these AI programs that whip their butts. So,
I was watching a PBS. I don't know if it was Frontline or one of those shows, but it was saying, is it a Japanese game called Go or something like that?
Oh, yeah, Go.
And
right.
They were saying that, like, the machine thinks of moves that a human just wouldn't think of because they're completely illogical. Mm-hmm. And that was how the machine broke the human.
With logic.
I talk about that in the book. There are actually two generations of Go programs.
Spock, just describe Spock.
Yeah.
True.
But Go is one of the most considered to be one of the most complicated games, certainly an ancient game.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a program called AlphaGo, and there was AlphaGo 1 and AlphaGo 2. And the first one kind of beat the champion. But then the second generation was a program that what we call a neural network program that can basically teach itself.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't instruct it.
Learning.
We just let it play itself.
Wow.
And as it played itself, it learned new moves. It learned innovative techniques.
Wow.
And things that we never, and the Go Champion will say, wow, I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm. So
Will a robot ever replace a go-go dancer?
What's that?
Will a robot ever replace a go-go dancer?
That happened in probably some 60s movie.
Not in my heart.
No. Not in your heart. Not in
my heart. There's actually a company in California that is making what we call sex bots.
There you go.
And there is now the very real concern that people will begin having sex with robots.
I think they have been.
Yeah, I don't think that's a new concern.
Yeah.
But the machine learning thing is really fascinating because it seems like some technology has stalled, like driverless cars, for example, because we don't know how to like program them yet in a way that is going to like guarantee the safety of everyone who's like in the car, around the car. And it's no, like, these are not easy questions. Like, we don't know yet how to program a car to decide, right? Between like, are you going to run over a dog or run over a, you know, old lady?
A judgment call.
Yeah.
Trick question.
It's like, maybe this is getting like too much into like sci-fi territory, but maybe like, you know, if we do have ever driverless cars, they're going to teach themselves. Like, they'll know better than us what best decision is.
My car has a lot of like indicators. It like indicates if a car is going by on the street and it beeps and... But there's nothing that lets me know if my dress is hanging out the door.
I've never seen you in a dress.
Exactly, but it is a good joke.
It really is, Louis.
Sometimes it's a scarf.
You suck me in.
But getting back to what Danny said, very good point, Danny. You know, I tell the story of that driverless car. I think it was in Arizona. It was driving at night. There was a person inside who was supposed to be monitoring, but he literally took his eyes off the control panel for just a second. I mean, just a second.
That's how it happened.
And in that moment, boom, it just ran over a woman who was rocking her bicycle across the street.
Mm. Wow.
And they later found out that the woman was on drugs and she was crossing where she shouldn't have. Sure. But that's the problem. How do you program for all the
inevitability
contingencies?
It's hard to program
story is they were interviewing one of the programmers and they said, well, let me give you a hypothetical. what if you know, a bus is going along the road and has to suddenly swerve. And on one side, on the other side of the road is a car coming towards the bus. And on the other side by the road is a mother and a child.
Mm.
What should the bus do if the bus is driverless? What should you program the bus to do?
Right. Yeah.
And the guy just shrugged it off. I swear to God, I quote him in the book. He says, we program it to hit the smallest thing.
Oh, no.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've kind of
there goes the dog.
Seen that like they're doing this research at like Stanford and places like the MIT. I'm sorry, MIT. Maybe also Stanford, where they like survey a bunch of people to see like what the majority says, like who would you rather die in this situation if that was? It's an extension of, I'm sure you're familiar with the trolley problem.
But Dina, even if the situation were happening, and even if someone was able to logically make a judgment call, they are still making it in half of a second.
Mm-hmm.
So
right, exactly.
So the outcome could be pretty similar, repeated from the machine to a human over and over again. It's still just something unfortunate is about to happen.
Yeah. Can you program a machine to react to an irrational situation? And that's what happens.
Any better than a human would.
You have
that's my question.
Half a second
right.
to act, and it's an irrational situation, something that may have never happened to you before.
Oh, come
that's
on.
That's why I think people should just stay home.
Yeah, Michael.
Michael.
You expect me to decide between a nun and Hitler? Come on, that is not...
A nun and Hitler?
The machine. I don't know. It's a trick question.
You can win and go.
I can't
pick Hitler.
I can't do this.
I've been reading a lot about self-driving
cars. I think that this is one example of where the technology has stalled because of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll iron it out with time. But the question is, even if we iron it out, my concern is that the first time there is a real tragedy, if you sue the company, it's game over.
Right.
Because if it's driverless car, who are you going to sue but the company?
That's
So they got to work out all the insurance issues
before.
Yeah.
There's too many variables.
Yeah.
My head is hurting me right now. Michael, here in Sherman Oaks, did you have a question for Dr. Michael?
Mm-hmm.
No, you had something.
No, tell us.
Come on, you're in the hot seat, Michael.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the whole self-driving cars thing is fascinating, and there's a lot of problems that have to be worked out, but I think that in the long run, they're going to be a lot safer because computers have much better reaction times than humans.
Certainly than what teenagers.
I've been reading, it sounds like the cars are going to be programmed just to choose what outcome will have the less impact on human life, which is scary because that means there's an option where the car is going to drive the driver off a cliff rather than hurt somebody on the road. So it's like your car could be programmed to kill you if it means that only you would die as opposed to like a group of three children that's on the road.
Right. Wow. So then, that raises the question, like, can we not have driverless cars until we're living in like a perfectly like ideal society where everyone...
With no cliffs.
The flip side is that they are so much safer, and so these incidences will come up so much less often than they do now.
But it's just so heartbreaking. It just reminds me of the plane that crashed in the Pennsylvania field and all those lives that we lost rather than having it crash and wash into Washington. Mm-hmm. We're going to break for commercial on that cheerful note.
Yeah, really. That was uplifting.
Get yourself a cozy beverage.
Hold on, wait, the phone lines are lighting up.
Oh, boy. A few people just passed a Coca-Cola through their nose.
Now count 10. There. Don't you feel better already? No. Why not? Oh, that's because that's anger management crap. Join me and learn real ways to overcome your anger. I share my own struggles and journey to break free of destructive anger. I will give you ideas and insight that will bring you to a place of healthy anger. Yes, there is such a thing. Learn how on That Anger Management Crap with Matthew Plotner.
Yay! You have been... Now, Michael, that's an anger management podcast that we all may want to check out.
The tone of voice.
But you have been exploring the intersection of science and Christianity, which we found on your website. Mm-hmm. And on your website, you state, the problem is enormous and urgent. Never before have young people been more anxious, fearful, or confused about life. Awash in social media, they are being ravaged by unprecedented levels of loneliness, depression, and suicide. In a world of viral misinformation, they have no idea who or what to trust. The notion of absolute truth is meaningless to them. At the root of it all are dysfunctional worldviews. So I'm going to pose this question. How well does your reality line up with absolute reality? And can you talk about this and what the difference is?
That's a great question. And let me just back up by saying that when I was a young man, I was born in East Los Angeles and in the middle of the Mexican barrio, and I had this dream to become a scientist, dating back to when I was in the second grade, and that dream took me to UCLA and then to Cornell, Harvard, and beyond that. But when I was at Cornell, I really became a scientific monk. I slept maybe 3 hours a day from about 3 a.m. to about 6 a.m. And the rest of the time, I was either holed up in my lab in the basement of the Lab of Nuclear Studies there, or I was in class learning about the universe. And I was an atheist. I mean, I didn't care about God. I didn't think about God. I had no social life. I cared about one thing and one thing only, and that was science. I was driven then, and as I am driven now, by trying to understand what's true, Louise. I don't want to get too deep in the program because we're trying to have some fun tonight. But if there is one theme in my life, it's that. It's just a very kind of rigorous-minded guy. He's an independent thinker. I don't care what other people think. I'm very curious. I'm curious about everything. I oftentimes compare myself to Henry Frankenstein, but not in the way that the book portrayed him. I'm not interested in piecing together dead body parts to create life. But the thing the impression that Henry Frankenstein, the character, especially Colin Clive in the 1931 version, the Carl Laemmle version I can watch that over and over and over again. And I did. And I had a poster of it in my Harvard office for so many years. But the thing about Henry Frankenstein was he too was a character seeking truth. He has this great monologue, and it's one where he confronts Dr. Waldman, who is kind of the old kind of stodgy, uptight guy. And he's, Henry has just brought this creature to life and they're kind of having a cigarette break. And Waldman warns Frankenstein, what have you done? You shouldn't have done this. You know, you should be very careful. And, you know, Colin Clive just responds by saying, look, I mean, I just want to find things out. I want to know what's true. And but he says it in such a beautiful way. Anybody who's watching has never watched that 1931 version, mm-hmm. watch it and watch for that soliloquy. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. So about maybe second year into my grad studies, I was just well aware of how magnificent the universe was through and through, from the tiniest level to the most astronomical level, you know, from quarks and gluons all the way through the macro world, all the way up to, you know, galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And so naturally, as an intellectual, I just asked myself the question, you know, how did a universe like this come to be? And I knew that science offered me some interesting answers, in particular what we call now the Standard Model of Cosmology, the SMC. And I won't get into it now. And for a long time, I bought into the equations. The math was beautiful. The thinking is quite elegant. To this day, I admire it. So it's a lot there to take very seriously. But it has some real problems. In fact, cosmology is one of my specialties, and we're in a crisis right now. There are certain very fundamental questions we just can't answer honestly. We can take stabs at answers, but we don't really have answers.
So we've gotten to a point where science may leave off and faith may pick up?
Well, here's what happened to me. So I said, when I began understanding the problems that the Standard Model of Cosmology had, I just thought to myself quite naturally, maybe I should leave the plantation of scientific ideas and kind of explore a broader world. And I remember Carl Sagan, who was a professor of mine there. Mm. Carl, I took courses from him in exobiology, he and Frank Drake, who's the father of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I was just very fortunate to be at Cornell at just the right mm-hmm. time. And I remember Carl always saying, Carl was, you know, kind of an agnostic. He was a non-believing Jew, but he always talked about the Vedas. And so I had a lot of respect for Carl. I still do. And so that was the days before the Google. So I went to Olin Library, the grad student library there at Cornell, and I looked up Vedas and I discovered, lo and behold, it's a sacred literature of the Hindu religion. And it fascinated me. So I did what I always do. I always just dive in with everything I've got. So I started studying Hinduism. I found it very fascinating. Then somebody gave me a copy of the I Ching, so I got into Chinese mysticism, Taoism, Confucianism, and then I studied the Quran and Islam. And then my thesis advisor, Richard Leiboff, was Jewish, so he started taking me to Shabbat services on Friday night. And I will inject a little humor here because this is the truth. After Shabbat services, he would take me home, and we'd have like a little Onik Shabbat. We would have a nosh together, uh-huh. and. He would offer me chopped chicken liver. And I said, Richard, my mom tried to fatten me up when I was a kid with fried liver. I hate it. No, thank you. And he kept pestering me Friday after Friday after Friday. So finally I gave in. I said, all right, I'll just try a little, put a little on a cracker. And it was his mother's recipe. He was very proud of it. And guess what? I loved it. So I say, on my way to exploring ideas outside the world of science, I learned to love chopped chicken liver.
You just put
but
a
only
little
Richard's
on a
mother's recipe. But then I won't get into the full story. But a co-ed at Cornell, who I ended up marrying, who listened to me about how I was exploring all these religions. Oh, I also got into TMI, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He was making the rounds at the time. And so I would go to his seminars and I would listen. I was fascinated by the fact that you could levitate if you were a devotee of TMI.
But don't go too high.
One day this co-ed challenged me. He says, well, you know, you've explored all these religions. You've lived all these religions. Have you ever read the Bible? And my reaction was no. And I gave her two reasons why. I said, number one, I grew up hearing about the Bible. It seemed very prosaic, very kind of lowbrow, and I didn't feel it had much of anything to teach to me. And then more importantly, I said to her, I have the impression that people who read the Bible hate science. And I love science. Science is like my whole world. And so she left it alone. She wasn't like some religious fanatic. And she herself, you know, was a lapsed Catholic. And so some days later, she said, you know, I haven't read the Bible either. If you read it, I'll read it with you. And then, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'm this uber geek.
Cool.
I've never had a girlfriend, never had a social life. And I thought, and she was a sorority girl. I'm thinking, well, if I could spend a little more time with this pretty girl, okay, I'll do it. Anyway, so.
That's how the Bible section.
So you took up the Bible for chicks?
Yeah. To believe it or not, I'm ashamed to admit it. It's a shameless thing.
Bible, chick magnet.
To be her
sorority sister. But the funniest thing was, because we were both kind of very, one of the things I loved about her was she's just really smart, like me, very curious. Asking deep questions, So we start reading the Bible literally from Genesis 1:1. Wow. And we start asking questions like, doesn't that contradict, you know, once we got a week in, it was like, didn't that contradict mm-hmm. what we just read last week? And then, and at one point I said to her, Laura, we're never going to get through this thing if we keep doing this. So we got a spiral notebook and literally started writing down all the questions.
Whoa.
And
we'll
come back to them later. But, and then I started comparing and contrasting these various worldviews with the scientific worldview, and through a very long process, many, many years. It's not like I had some kind of big aha moment. I'm an intellectual, so it takes me a long time to come to conclusions. I'm very circumspect. I'm very thorough. I'm very rigorous. I demand answers to my questions. I demand them to be rigorous. Above all, they have to be consistent with science. And I made the decision that the worldview that was most consistent with science of all these others was Christianity, for a whole variety of reasons. So I have lived comfortably with that. And to answer you, I mean, that's a very, I'm sorry, Louise, that's a very long-winded way of answering your question, which is, I hope that my worldview is quite consistent with absolute reality.
Well, what I'm hoping is that you can save us. Because if you can help all Christians understand that science is their friend, you can maybe save the planet. Yes. So so help me understand how you're helping people understand.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, and it is a source of enormous. What's the word? Sadness, concern,
consternation.
I think that so many of my fellow Christians are suspicious of science, kind of question science, is because they have been given the impression, or they've gotten the impression somehow, that science is the enemy of Christianity.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've heard that.
And that's too bad, because it's not true. And the book that I'm just now finishing, that's going to be coming out in the fall, mm-hmm. is an attempt, really, to explain, not to the public, but also to my fellow Christians. Look, no, science is not the enemy. quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that they will take it to heart. But
do you have a title?
Yeah,
for this
sometimes
book?
I feel like I'm kind of in the middle, Louise. Like I'm between kind of the. Well, I get what you're saying, and that's what I'm hoping. And at the same time, I'm hoping that scientists also don't perceive Christianity as the enemy, because it isn't.
That's really
key.
It's
quite remarkable.
Michael, I've got something I want to share with you that you feel free to use, because I got it from somewhere.
Yes, please.
Did you hear about the agnostic, dyslexic, insomniac? He would toss and turn all night long, wondering whether or not there was a dog.
Okay.
Pause for laugh. Okay.
Dyslexic.
For Michael.
It's time. I love it. May I use that?
Yes, absolutely.
Both religion and politics often go head to head against science. Not just religion, but also politics will go head to head against science. And my nephew says that science doesn't care whether you believe in it or not.
That's a great line.
But people care, because if our leaders do not listen to science, and they are creating policies for the climate, for a coronavirus, etc., which are not protecting people. So how can we all help promote the concept that science must be well, must be heard.
By reading Michael's book that's coming out in the fall.
We need a longer list than that.
Yeah.
That's a great start.
That's just an excellent question, and there's so much I could say in response to it. First of all, your nephew's mistaken. Science does want you to believe in it.
Okay.
It's very important to us scientists that that people believe in it. But in order to believe in it, you have to understand it. And the same thing goes for Christianity and for Judaism, for Hinduism, for anything. First, you have to do your homework. And that's what I tell young people. You know, I go around college campuses speaking to them about science and God and the intersection of those two worlds. And my exhortation to them is, don't even take my word for anything. You've got to think for yourself the way I have and the way I continue to. But you've got to do your homework. Otherwise, you're thinking about what? I mean, you're just thinking about nothing.
It's based on nothing.
You have to have something to think about. So you have to do your homework. As far as politics is concerned, the one thing, I'm old school. I really feel like the scientific method is sacred. I really take science very seriously. And I thought, in my own naivete, I guess, that maybe science would be the one thing that would not become politicized. Mm-hmm. I'd already seen so many of the other aspects of our lives, including religion, become politicized. Mm-hmm. But I thought, science, it's not.
Nothing's
not going to succumb to politics. Nothing. And unfortunately, it has. And we don't have the time to get into it, but the whole funding mechanism for science, the whole publication process of science.
Has that changed your horizon? Has that changed?
Problem. It's a real problem. And so I guess I would say to your nephew, number one, that I share his concern. I share that there are too many people today, not only in the United States, but around the world, who have a misperception about science, and they have a misperception about Christianity and religion in general. How do you educate people to outgrow those misperceptions? Mm-hmm. I try as best I can doing shows like this, by writing books. That's all I can do. And I'm hopeful that maybe one or two people listening will take the time to start doing their own homework. But we've got to start depoliticizing everything. Everything is so political. I try to stay out of it. I really just care about truth. And that's the one little thing I've staked out in life for myself. And I'm going to just stick there until the day they bury me.
Well,
I don't want to get involved.
Well, before we move on to what's Twitter trending, which is a segment that we close with. Let's start with the opening paragraph of the Bible, which I'm no scholar, but I believe it says that God created the heavens and the earth in 7 days. So that's how the book opens, and that would be probably religious people's first inclination that they have to take sides, that either the scientist version of the creation of the earth is true, or the Bible's version. So how do you address that opening paragraph?
Yeah.
They didn't bury it.
Again, it's a very good thing. And I wrote a book called Amazing Truths, How Science and the Bible Agree, and I devote an entire chapter to that very question, Louis.
It's an important
question. In the limited time we have, I'll just simply say this, and that is, when you look at the Hebrew, not the English translation, but the Hebrew, and I've spoken to rabbis and rabbinical scholars about this over the many, many years. And the word day is the word yom. And the plural of yom is yamim. So when the Bible speaks about God creating everything from soup to nuts in 6 days, and then he rested on the seventh, he's talking about six yamim. If you look at if you understand ancient Hebrew, you'll understand that it's a very small vocabulary. It's not like English. It's very robust, not like other languages that are very robust, very large vocabulary. Ancient Hebrew had very few words, and so each word had to do double, triple, quadruple weight. It had to. Mm-hmm. It had many meanings.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Each word, and so when you look at the word yom and you ask what does it mean, what does that critical word mean? Then it can mean, yes, a 24-hour day. It can also mean just an indefinite period of time. Mm-hmm. It has other meanings, but those two are kind of the ones at issue right now.
So it goes between
a day.
So
what happens is that people will read the English translation. Again, they're too lazy. Again, that's what I was saying. Do mm-hmm. your homework. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do your homework. Mm-hmm. People are just so lazy.
Or they want to be tribal. They want to pick a team and have it be against another team.
So some people will read the English translation and they'll say, oh, day means, 24-hour day. Well, maybe not. But here's the more exciting thing. And this is, I guess, this is the thing that I want to get across to your viewers. When you really start taking this stuff seriously and get past all the noise and get past all the rancor and the disagreement and the politics, you just quietly study and dig deep. This is what you find. In special relativity, up until special relativity, which was in 1905, science believed that time and space were absolute. I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to make this real quick. Mm-hmm. We believe that 10 seconds to you was always 10 seconds to me, was 10 seconds to anybody else in the universe. Time was absolute. Mm-hmm. But Einstein, with his theory of relativity, explained that no, that's not the case. Time is elastic. It depends on your reference frame. So even quite apart from your interpreting the word yawn, even if you insist that it's six 24-hour days versus what science is saying, which is the universe is about 13.8 billion years, it's clearly a disagreement there. That disagreement can be resolved if you can take into consideration that time is elastic. Mm-hmm. And even in the Bible, it speaks about how a day for God is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like a day. So that's basically a statement of special relativity. So, Louise, I guess I would just simply say, yeah, there will always be, as you say, maybe tribal, or I just think I chalk it up a little bit to laziness. I think that when I have, over the years, as I have studied the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, of course, I've studied science all my life. I understand the universe and how it works. There's no fundamental disagreement.
So the day itself was still an abstract concept because without a sun and without an earth, there was not yet to be a day.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Wow. There you go. Well, they certainly didn't bury the headline.
And you know what the tragedy is? if people would only understand science more, they would realize that scientific understand actually informs the reading of the Bible. It actually makes it more interesting, not less interesting.
I agree.
But again, that's why I exhort people, just do your homework. Right. Don't even just take my word for it. Just do your homework, discover it for yourself.
I love that. Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to go to what's Twitter trending? Because I know you want to know, Dr. G.
Yeah.
What's Twitter trending today? And I'm gonna tell you what's Twitter trending, and then I'm gonna ask the class if they know why.
Okay.
What was Twitter trending today is Laura Petri. Who knows why?
Because there's a concentration of coronavirus in New Rochelle.
And because pedal pushers are coming back into style.
The Petris on the Dick Van Dyke Show, Dr. G, lived in New Rochelle. And there's a concentration of corona outbreaks in New Rochelle. So there's kind of like a gentle quarantine or an advisement of people in that area not to go to the movies or converge and share spit. And so so New Rochelle and Laura Petri were trending today. And we have Tyler Curtin who tweets, let's see, Rob and Laura Petri are under quarantine. And then Greg Akers tweets, a section of New Rochelle, New York has been quarantined. Ain't that where Rob and Laura Petri and their son, Richie, live? Yes. I hope Alan Brady, a.k.a. Carl Reiner, is checking in on them. This is getting serious, folks. And Serendipity Dizzle tweets, can you imagine Laura Petri having to deal with this? Go ahead, Danny.
Oh, Rob! Now, what's the matter, dear?
She looks.
Maybe Jerry will come over.
Maybe. Don't they have a dentist that could help with this? Yeah. They have a dentist friend, I believe.
There's a neighbor.
Michael, Dr. Michael.
You know, it's like trying to get into the 4 billion people's minds. That's Twitter, right?
Two or three is scary.
It really just takes one Mary Tyler Moore expression for everyone to get what's going on. Like, oh, yeah, she's exasperated.
There's no such thing as mob wisdom.
All right, Dr. G, where can we find you online? Let's see, we have you on Facebook. We have you on,
oh, he's everywhere.
Twitter, Instagram. Yeah. You guys, can you pull up some of his socials?
Yeah.
Yeah, michaelgillen.com.
Fascinating stuff.
We just revamped my website. I'm very proud of it.
Oh, your website looks amazing.
Yes, it does look
great. Oh, do you like it? Thanks, Louise. Yeah. We just got that done. Thank you.
It's really good.
Got that new car smell.
It does.
Can I get rid of these paper mats?
And there you are on Instagram.
Yep.
And there's thanks to my
Gen Z son. He taught me how to get on Instagram.
Oh, your son.
I'm learning little by little. And as I go to colleges, the kids are helping me figure out, you know, what's the difference between the hashtag and the at sign. And it gets all very complicated. Look, I understand physics and astronomy and math, but, you know, I'm on a learning curve.
I walked into the studio pre-show, Dr. G, and I walked up to Franny and Michael in the booth, and I said, is this my DMs? And they stifled a laugh. They did. They stifled very nicely, very appropriately.
I'm with you, Louise. I'm with you. Right. I'm learning as I'm going.
Thank you to our guest, Dr. Michael Gillen, to our panel, Jamie Alcroft and Danny Mann. Our producer is Dina Friedman. Our tech team is Michael Telep and Francesco D'Amanda. Our sound designer is John Maddox. Our webmaster is Bill Filipiak. Our theme music is The Coffee Song by me, Louise Palenker, and John Maddox. I am Louise Palenker, and we will see you next week. Be safe, elbow bump, be well, cough into your sleeve, be kind, but don't share your straw. Goodbye.